Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Faithfully Memphis with Bishop Phoebe Rofe. This is Tom Momberg. I'm a priest who serves with Bishop Phoebe in the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Every Thursday at 8 a.m., we have the opportunity to speak with interesting people and to learn about the role that faith plays in their lives. We are broadcast from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. At the beginning of each Faithfully Memphis broadcast, we identify a saint, a hero in faith, someone whose life embodies the love of God. Ida B. Wells Barnett has become one of my heroes, my sheroes. She is an unofficial but very real saint, and I try to honor her by learning more and more about her faithful life and her work. Ida was, among other things, one of the founders of the NAACP. For that and other reasons, she was declared a, quote, dangerous Negro agitator by the FBI. Nicknamed by others as the Princess of the Press for her audacious and courageous writing about lynchings and other racial injustices, she was also known as the Queen of her race. She marched with the Illinois delegation of the women's suffrage movement, insisting on being with her white sisters despite their resistance. Let me tell you a story that for me and for many of us here in Memphis made me want to know more about Ida B. Wells when I first heard the story. Once upon a time, there were three black men, Calvin McDowell, Henry Stewart, and Thomas Moss. They ran a successful store in Memphis called the People's Grocery, located in their own neighborhood. The People's Grocery was in competition with a white-owned store across the street. On March 9th, 1892, the white store owner gathered up a mob and attacked his black competitors. The mob executed all three black men. One of the men, Thomas, had asked Ida B. to be godmother to his daughter. For the sake of that daughter, his wife, and their unborn child, he begged the white men for his life. When he was asked if he had anything to say before he died, Thomas replied, "Tell my people to go west. There is no justice for them here." After Thomas died, his dear friend, Ida B. Wells, wrote, quote, "Somebody must show that the Afro-American race is more sinned against than sinning, and it seems to have fallen upon me to do so." Close quotes. Born in 1862 into slavery in Marshall County, Mississippi, Ida B. Wells began her adult fight for racial and gender justice in Memphis. Long before the civil rights movement of the 1960s, she was asked by the conductor of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad to move from her ticketed first-class ladies' car seat to the Jim Crow section of the train. Wells, 22 years old at the time, refused. She was forcibly removed. Under the 1875 Civil Rights Act, Wells was able to win a lawsuit against the railroad. And although she was awarded a settlement, the verdict was reversed by the Tennessee Supreme Court. Ida began her work as a journalist by writing columns in church newspapers. Saving money from her daytime teaching job, she became co-partner of the Free Speech and Headlight newspaper, along with her pastor at Beale Street Baptist Church. Through that newspaper, Wells became a full-time advocate for education, civil rights, and the prevention of violence against blacks. In her book, Passionate for Justice, Ida B. Wells as Prophet for Our Time, Dr. Catherine Meeks writes how Wells connected the dots behind the motivations for the People's Grocery lynching and many others. She discerned how lynchings of black people were not responses to individual crimes, but part of a system-wide effort to reestablish white supremacy throughout the South. In fact, Wells began a study of 728 lynchings over the previous 10 years. 2 months after the People's Grocery lynchings, Wells was in New York City. She had just published a righteously angry editorial about the real reasons black people were lynched. One of her New York friends, the editor of a newspaper, greeted her this way: "Well, we've been a long time getting you to New York, but now that you are here, I'm afraid you'll have to stay." He showed her a copy of another New York paper, which described what happened in Memphis after her editorial. Her offices had been burned to the ground. Ida B. Wells was threatened with being lynched herself if she returned to Memphis. She became part of the Great Migration, calling Chicago home for the bulk of her adult life. Ida B. did not return to the South again until some 30 years later. In many ways, Dr. Meeks writes, this relocation was a major turning point for Ida Wells. She was determined to work against lynching and racism and for women's rights on a national and international level. In other words, Wells was moved from words to action. But it was her words that caused her to be honored posthumously just last year with a Pulitzer Prize special citation. That citation read, quote, "To Ida B. Wells for her outstanding and courageous reporting on the horrific and vicious violence against African Americans during the era of lynching." And this summer, God willing, on the anniversary of her birth, a new statue of Ida B. Wells will be erected on Beale Street. In our own day, as in Ida B.'s, music can often help words of truth to be heard. Protest songs have their own history in this country. In the 60s, new voices began to cry out for justice. One of the strongest voices was Joan Baez, a woman of Latina descent. Joan recorded a song not about a lynching, but about an equally terrifying event that happened 57 years ago in Birmingham, Alabama, involving the Ku Klux Klan and four little girls. This song has been covered more recently by another woman of color. Her name is Rhiannon Giddens. The song is Birmingham Sunday.
I'll sing you a song. I'll sing. sing it so softly, it'll do no one wrong. On Birmingham Sunday, the blood ran like wine, and the choirs kept singing of freedom. That cold autumn morning, no eye saw the sun, and Addie Mae Collins, her number was one. At an old Baptist church, there was no need to run, and the choirs kept singing of freedom. The clouds, they were gray, and the autumn wind blew, and Denise McNair brought the number to two. The Falcon of Death was a creature they knew, and the choirs kept singing of freedom. Kept singing of freedom. Young Carol Robinson entered the door, and the number her killers had given was four. She asked for a blessing, but asked for no more, and the choirs kept singing of freedom.
Choirs
Well, it's my privilege and pleasure to introduce our special guest for today. John Ashworth is someone who many of us in Memphis got to know through the work we share in an organization called the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis. John quickly became a friend to me because he reached out and included me in that work in all the ways that good Christian friends do. A significant moment in our friendship was when John agreed to come to an all-white church I was then serving in Scottsboro, Alabama, to make a presentation during Black History Month. That church had never observed the month of February in that way. And on that Sunday, John dared to tell us a story about his own enslaved ancestors. So I want to stop there, and before I officially say hello to John, read you the biography that he has given me. John Ashworth is a veteran, Vietnam War veteran, with 21 years military service, followed by 20 years of commercial aviation management. His educational pursuits include studies at Tennessee State University, Columbia College, Missouri, Eastern Michigan University, Ypsilanti, Michigan, and DeVry Institute of Technology in Atlanta. In 2007, he returned to his adopted hometown of Brownsville, Tennessee, and pursued with diligence his interest in African American history. In addition to being the president of the board of directors of the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis and a board member of Tennesseans for Historical Justice, John is also a co-founder of the Dunbar Carver Museum in Brownsville, co-founder and treasurer of the Geneva Miller Historical Society, chairperson of the Elbert Williams Memorial Committee. As you've gathered, John is an underachiever. The advantages of living in a small town allows him to remain civically engaged in the community, and he is also the secretary of the Haywood County Election Commission, a member of the Historic Zoning Commission and Brownsville Regional Planning Commission. As he describes it, "I don't sit around well." But he is an avid reader, a quasi-serious chess player, an amateur photographer, a lover of travel, and above all, he says his most cherished and important title and commitment is, as co-director, I assume with his wife, Char, of the Ashworth Center for Exceptional Grandchildren. That's John, me. Welcome. Welcome.
Good morning, and my sincere appreciation to you and Bishop Roth for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And we're glad that you and your wife, Char, are here today with us. So, John, we have some questions that we have prepared. Okay. And I say we because you and I have worked together on these questions. So yes. Full disclosure about that.
Okay.
And the first question that I have, most of these questions have kind of two parts to them. So the first two-part question is, how influential was the Black church experience while you were growing up?
Okay.
And how important is religion to you today?
Okay. Let me start with the first question, obviously. I grew up in Middle Tennessee, Wilson County. I grew up with my grandparents. My mother passed from my birth, so I grew up with my grandparents. We lived way out in the country, and we're talking about, I was born in 1943, so full disclosure there. As I said, we lived way out in the country. We had no running water. We had no electricity. But my grandfather owned his own farm, and so we had our own land. And the area that we lived in was an area of Wilson County that the land was not desirable for farming, and thus there was a very large group of African Americans that were able to acquire land in that community. And so my grandfather donated a small plot of land to have a church, and we did. In fact, the building is still standing. Yeah. And we had church once a month. It was a circuit preacher that had other churches, and of course, once a month they did that. But we obviously did not have youth programs. We did not have choirs. We had none of that.
Yes.
It was just simply go to church on a Sunday. You'd hear the preaching. That would be about it. And so, but I knew that religion was very important because before we had any meal, we prayed. Before you went to bed at night, you said your prayers. And so I knew that religion was important. Although, kind of on the side note, I didn't question religion or my faith, but I did have a little bit of a take back on the one. Once about two or three times a year, the minister would have dinner at our house after church.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I, along with the other kids, got a little bit upset because when they finished, there was no good parts of the chicken left. And most of the pies and desserts are gone. But now, you asked the other side of the question. You asked me, how important is religion to you now? And as you know, I like to do a little bit of critical thinking about what words mean and what religion mean. And one of the things that I looked at and I did, even as I was getting ready to do this, is to say, how do I answer that question?
Hmm.
And the first question I ask is that in contemporary, what is religion? Having grown up and gotten some level of education coupled with life experiences, I've continued to do, as most people do, begin to think critically about religion, Christianity, spirituality, faith, the supreme being. And what has emerged out of that for me is that two things, that I have a very sincere faith that there is a supreme being. And if you were to ask me how I practice that faith with others, my answer is that I would generally align myself with those of the Protestant denominations or beliefs. Needless to say that in the course of my 21 military career and my additional 20 years in aviation management, I've lived in many places and participated with religious denominations of all kinds. So that's kind of shaped. But if you ask me now, it's basically Protestant. I'm a member of a Baptist church. I'm also a deacon in that church. And so that's kind of where I am now.
And John, that makes a lot of sense to me, knowing you a bit, because back to the way you befriended me, being a pastor in a different denomination, an Episcopal church priest, that didn't stand in the way.
No.
I know that you have also welcomed folks who are not Christian, who are Jewish, who are Muslim, who practice other faith traditions, or maybe practice no faith tradition.
True.
So I'm not surprised at your answer. I do want to follow up and say something about this small church seminar work that you've been invited into at the seminary.
Yeah. My pastor, who is also a very good friend of mine, a very, very educated man. In fact, I think he's listening now, Reverend Lewis Hudson. He started working on his DME and his doctor ministry in African-American church studies. And he was doing that through the Louisville Presbyterian Seminary. And so he invited me to go with him about four times to various seminars there.
Wow. Yes.
That was focused on rural ministry in the African-American context. To begin to look at in small rural communities, to begin to look at what that experience is like and the kinds of things that were taking place and what the changes are that are affecting Black churches today, especially in small rural communities. And so we've been very engaged in that.
And that makes a lot of sense, I guess, also for both you and your pastor, because you are in a smaller, I would assume, smaller rural church.
Right.
And again, that makes total sense to me that you would be involved in that. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit with this next question, and that is about where you've lived. You've lived a lot of places, just as I have.
Yes.
And the question that I want to ask you is, what have been some of the most memorable places? There are some that you'd like to forget, perhaps. I don't know.
No, not really.
Not really. Okay. And then the follow-up to that is, how do you see you and your family as in any way part of the Great Migration?
Good question. Interesting question. Actually, all the places that we live were memorable. But going back to what I said about my ideas about faith in a supreme being, I always made it a point to find something that I liked about every place that I've lived. But if the question was what place did I enjoy the most, it would without question be the 4 years that I lived in the Caribbean. And not because of the sun, sea, and sand. In the early 70s, I lived on the island of St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And the thing that I enjoyed most of why that is the most enjoyable is that I did not have to wake up daily and breathe the heavy air of covert and overt racism or the constant reminders in so many subtle ways that you are black. To be sure, there were those things that existed that smacked of all of that. I mean, after all, this was the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so I guess the place that I liked the least was Indianapolis, Indiana. And again, it wasn't anything horrible about the city. It had more to do with the weather. It seemed to me that summer was slightly longer than 2 months, and the sun disappeared around Memorial Day. I detested those gray skies of the Midwest, but on the other hand, I found myself doing a lot of reading. The downtown Indianapolis had a really great library. So St. Croix is you know, again, for not reasons of sun and sand, but the reasons of being able to breathe what appeared to be freer air than I could breathe in the U.S., although it was still U.S.
It's an important image, especially today, about being able to breathe.
Yeah, yes, it is.
Any kind of air.
I wasn't thinking it when I made that connection, but yes, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, and you asked about how were you and your family a part of the Great Migration? And that's one of those words, you know, you and I have often talked about vocabulary and words having meaning. And let me say a couple of things about the Great Migration as it relates to African Americans. One of the many flaws in our country is the way of lumping everything into one convenient bracket to explain what we really don't know about, and especially what we don't want to talk about. There were those African Americans who did, in fact, migrate for better working and living conditions, but there were also those African Americans who were refugees in their own country. Mm. When massacres and lynchings occurred, people fled at that very moment in all directions for fear of death, never to be reconnected with their families again. And I think that's very important. When I say that they fled immediately, I'm talking about if the lynching occurred right now at 8 o'clock, by 8:05, as soon as they heard, they were on their way out, leaving anything and everything behind. And so, I'm not aware of any of my family members that fled under those conditions of fear of death. But I have many relatives in Chicago and Detroit and other cities in the Midwest that did, in fact, migrate for better opportunity and working conditions.
So thanks for reminding me that those labels do mislead us.
They do.
Sometimes. And there is more than one reason. There are many reasons.
There is.
Why African Americans needed to leave where they were living, sometimes right. At a moment's notice. Thank you, John. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of moving around and coming home, you came home to West Tennessee in 2007. So that's been like 14, is that right? 14 years ago.
Yeah, somewhere along in there, yeah.
Yeah. Why is Brownsville your adopted home?
Well, I moved back to West Tennessee in 2007. My dad, as I said earlier as we started out, my mother died from my birth as a result of my birth. And so my father and mother were living in Brownsville when she became pregnant with me. And because there was a complication, she went back to Middle Tennessee with my grandparents and, of course, died from my birth. And Dad came back and had his career here, and he remarried. After my grandfather passed in 1956, I came to live with him and my stepmother, and I graduated high school there in 61. I have no brothers and sisters. And so when I retired in 2007, all my kids are now grown. You know, they live in Georgia, they live in Florida, they live in Texas, and my stepmother was still there. And so I moved back home. This is why I moved back to Brownsville. And so that's kind of why Brownsville is home now. So it's kind of like my adopted home, but we travel as often as possible. And yes. Of course, COVID has put a wrinkle on all of that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I know that you are also a grandfather, as I am. And,
yes.
And one of the things.
And a great grandfather.
And a great grandfather. Yes. Congratulations
Thank
for
you.
That, too.
Thank
and,
you.
And we grandparents are ready to travel to see our children and our
Absolutely.
Grandchildren and our great grandchildren.
Absolutely.
So we're hopeful that'll happen as soon as possible. Well, John, I want to ask you some more questions, and these go a little deeper than the other questions. And the first question, you've already been talking about this to some degree. When did you first become aware of racism in your own life? Now, I want to just tell you that I first became aware of racism when my parents moved us five children to Memphis from Cincinnati. I was 13 years old, and they were looking for a house. And one day I heard my mother say to my father, "We're firing that realtor. We are not going to work with that realtor because of the way they talk about African Americans." And that was my kind of first moment of awareness, even though I was already 13.
Right.
What about you? What was your first awareness of racism?
You know, an interesting question. My first awareness, there are two incidents that stand out in my mind from my childhood, and they're not well, let me just describe them. As I said earlier, I grew up living way out in the country with my grandparents, and my grandfather owned his own land, so and he had no powered mechanical instruments. We depended on horses and mules for all the transportation and powering needs. And that subsequently also meant that the few times that we did go in to go shopping, I'm saying that to say, and let me back up, I had very, very early on, I had very little contact with white people. As I said, the neighborhood I lived in was predominantly black. But on those rare occasions, he would hitch up the horses and wagon, and he and my grandmother would go into Lebanon, Tennessee to go shopping, primarily for staples. I, by that time, had developed a love of reading. I learned to read very early on. And in the store where they bought most of their staples, adjacent to that, the reason I learned loved reading is I started reading the cartoons in the newspaper that my grandfather subscribed to. Adjacent to the store where they did most of their shopping, there was a drugstore. The drugstore that had a round rack of comic books back in the 50s. And I could see that drugstore, and I could look through the window, and I could see two or three little white boys about my age sitting on the floor reading those comic books. I longed to go in and read those comic books also. And I don't know how I knew, and no one ever really said it to me, but I knew that I was not allowed to do that. And that realization set in, you know, and I say that to point the fact out, it's in the air.
Yes.
It's not something that you have to be taught. It's just in the air. Everybody knew that place, and they stayed in that place. And the other incident, in Lebanon, Tennessee, again, my uncle lived in Nashville, Tennessee, and I think it was for a Christmas holiday that we were going to go there and visit them. It's about a 30-mile distance, no interstate then. And so we're going to catch a Trailways bus to do that. And somehow we went into Lebanon, my grandfather, my grandmother, and I, to catch the Trailways bus to go to Nashville. And somehow, and I'm not sure why now, but my grandfather and I got on the bus before my grandmother did. And we had taken our seats. And when my grandmother started to get on the bus driver was just very, very mean and rough with her. And of course, I sit there and I looked at that, and I'm feeling powerless. I'm hurt because there's nothing I can do. And so those two things are the things that stand out as the earliest reminders that there is a place that you occupy in this society as an African-American that is less than everybody else's.
And those stories get to the next piece of this question for me, which is about those are personal experiences you had. And now the work that you're doing and that I'm sharing with you in the Lynching Sites Project of Memphis. How is lynching personal for you? I want to say something about that to clarify what I mean.
Okay.
Lynching didn't become personal for me until the 100th anniversary, the centennial commemoration of the L. Persons lynching. And as you well know, you were the project manager. You know that all too well. You made that happen, that commemoration. And there's a lot we could say about that. But it was my first time to actually put my body in the place where that kind of commemoration was happening. And something happened to me that made this personal, meaning I want to know more. I don't want to know more, and I want to know more, both.
Good.
As a white person.
Yes.
Yeah, it's painful, but I just saw the kind of the, not kind of, the real authenticity of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And as a pastor and someone who tries to pay attention to his spiritual life, it felt very spiritual to me, mm-hmm. very connected to mm-hmm. one another and to God. So there was that. And then there was also that very important time we shared, you and I, at the opening 3 years ago, the end of this month, it's hard to believe, John,
mm-hmm.
in Montgomery, Alabama, of the Equal Justice Initiative's Legacy Museum and what people now call the Lynching Memorial.
Right.
The Memorial for Peace and Justice.
Urge everybody to visit.
Well, yes, we both know from experience, again, personally,
right,
how lynching becomes real.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't already. And then, of course, there's what's going on today in our midst, especially what's going on in the state of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
So how is lynching personal for you?
Yeah, and good question. I have in my possession a database with the names of a little over 3,800 black victims of lynching between 1870 and 1950. The definition of a lynching is that it's an extrajudicial killing. And then, of course, there are those official bodies that add to that definition, say it is when it's done by a group of three or more. And so the way it's made personal for me and most African Americans, and I don't pretend to speak for the entire African American community this morning, but I think most of them will share this with me, is that the killing of Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, Stephon Clark, Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, Alton Sterling by police with no charges sends the same message as that list of 3,800 sends, the exact same message in the 21st century, that black lives have no value.
Mm.
This rings especially true as we watch the system literally right now fighting itself to prove whether a white police officer did or did not kill a black man that the whole world witnessed. And what I find interesting about that is that on the one hand, you look at the amount of effort put forth to prove that he did, and you look at the same amount of effort being put forth to prove that he did not. And those two things stand in contrast with each other.
Mm.
But more importantly, those two things point to where we still are, even as we talk about the 3,800 that was lynched. That legacy is still very much with us.
Mm. I'm thinking about this cartoon I brought it with me that was in the Memphis Commercial Appeal yesterday, The Game of Life or Death,
mm-hmm.
and it shows the path for white people and the path for death, mm-hmm. for black people. White people get stopped by the police. A polite officer gives you a warning. An officer says, have a nice day, and you're on your merry way,
mm-hmm.
according to this cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Black folks get stopped by the police. An officer pulls a gun on you. You get pulled from the car. And then the last thing says, dead end.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in our own local main newspaper here in Memphis, which leads me, John, to back to our faith and to the church,
mm-hmm.
and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I want to frame what I'm going to say about this next question, and I'm going to say the question and then frame it and ask you to answer it.
Okay.
The question is, how Christian do you think the church is today? And before you go there,
okay,
let me read this.
Go ahead.
If I may.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Genesis,
okay,
chapter 4, verses 8 to 11.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Lord said to Cain, where is your brother? Cain said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? The Lord said, what have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground.
Okay.
And this story, this scripture story that is familiar to us perhaps by the label that doesn't tell the whole story, Cain and Abel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question really should be, well, who's Cain and who's Abel in this story, even today? And a man named Robert P. Jones,
mm-hmm.
Someone whose writing I've been following, he's published a recent book, White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in White Christianity. And he says, having cited this story from Genesis, we white Christian Americans are Cain. So how Christian do you think the church really is today, John?
Yeah, and again, that's an interesting question. And the name Christian, again, as you know, I think critics like to look things up. The name Christian occurs three times in the New Testament, twice in Acts and once in 1 Peter. I'm not a student of theology, but in my lay understanding, being a Christian would imply and indicate that you're following the teachings of Jesus. I think those teachings would include humility, repentance, and, as often quoted, the greatest of all is love. Love for all of mankind, there are no filters on that. We are our brother's keeper. I think a Christian's answer to the oft-asked question about being my brother's keeper, who is my neighbor, I think the answer to that question should always be an understanding that my neighbor is not a geographical term. There is no one who is not your neighbor. So in answer to your question of how Christian do I think the church is today, and I want to be very respectful of the station that I'm on, and of the audience that is listening, and simply say there is a lot of work that remains undone and a lot of improvements that could be made towards being our brother's keeper and caring about our neighbors. And let me just share an additional observation. I understand there are somewhere in the range of 2,000 churches in Memphis, so it is only natural to think that the members of those churches would consider themselves Christians. My challenge to them, as it is my challenge to myself, and I'm speaking in the current language and environment that we're in right now, if I or you or all of us were charged with being a Christian, could the prosecution find enough evidence to convict us?
Yes.
Or would the devil have an easier time coming to our defense? I think it's, you know, which one would be easier? You know, and having said that, go ahead.
I'll just follow up with something I read in a brand new book by Michelle Duster, who is the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
Ida B., the Queen, is the name of the book. But she, in this wonderful new book, gives us part of a letter that Frederick Douglass wrote to Ida B. Wells about her work and about Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just read this piece. If our American conscience were only half alive, if the American church and clergy were only half Christianized, if American moral sensibility were not hardened by persistent infliction of outrage and crime against colored people, as was the phrase at the time, a scream of horror, shame, and indignation would rise to heaven wherever your works are read. Ida B. Wells' writings.
And
that was a long time ago, John.
Yes, and that is still a very true statement. And let me just talk for a moment. As you and I talked about the type of work that I'm doing with the Lynching Sites Project, that I'm doing with Tennesseans for Historical Justice, and as I said, I do like to think critically, I do like to read, and I do like to do research. And one of the questions, and you heard my presentation back in October, one of my presentations that, and something that this work has pushed me to, is to begin to ask the question, why is racism so intractable even now in the 21st century? And I've done a lot of work and research on that, and most discussions about the African-American experience in this country began with 1619. There is currently the competing dialogue between the 1619 project and the 1776 project. The 1619, of course, focusing more on the enslavement of African people, and the 1776 focused more on this country declaring its independence. But if you're going, I think, this is me talking now, I think if you're really going to get to the heart of what's underneath all of this, even before 1619, you've got to go back much further in history. And I've been doing some research. In fact, I think the Episcopal Church even wrote about it in one of their recent newsletters.
Yes.
the doctrine of discovery. I think to begin to get a real understanding of what's really underneath this hate that seems so intractable, if you go back to the 15th century, 1452, Pope Nicholas of the Roman Catholic Church in Europe issued what is known as a papal bull. And in that papal bull is called the Doctrine of Discovery. And let me just kind of give you the essence of what he actually decreed. Now, to really understand that, you would need to go back and do some degree of research on papal supremacy, mm-hmm. on the idea of papal supremacy. Mm-hmm. That, and that starts way, way back, even before the 15th century. But in 1452, Pope Nicholas issued a papal bull. And what he said, and eventually saying, the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, to invade, to search out, to capture, to vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever, wherever they go and they find lands that are not ruled by people who are Christian, and to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery, to apply and appropriate to himself and his successors the kingdoms, the dukedoms, the principalities, the possession and goods, and to convert them to his and their use and profit. Now, that was the one that was issued in 1452. And you had a series of these papal bulls that were issued by the church to the nations of Europe, to the countries of Europe, that they could go into other parts of the world and do that. And that was the basis in 1493 when the papal bull was issued giving Portugal to go and search out the west coast of Africa, which is how you got the Portuguese as the first slave traders. But it also gave to Spain the rights to go into the Americas, or what we know as America today, which is how we got Christopher Columbus. But and my point in saying this is to understand that this idea that people who were non-white Christians were less than human, and it gave them the right to go in, that idea is still with us to this day. So when you come down to the founding of America, you have the founders who came with these ideas. But when they set the government up, they specifically did not set up a religious state. In fact, they separated the church and state in the First Amendment to the Constitution. But they themselves were believers. And when you look at a lot, even if you look at January the 6th, or what happened in Washington January the 6th, you saw all kinds of religious iconography that was a part of that. I was listening, as I shared with you before we started, I was listening to one of the earlier broadcasts from here, and Bishop Robb asked the question, has capitalism and nationalism replaced God? And I don't think it has. Here's what I think has happened as I began to look and do a little bit of research on this. As I said, I'm not a theologian or an academic, but as I began to look at this, what I think has happened, it's not that capitalism and nationalism has replaced God, but I think what we've done is we've taken a lot of these evil ideas and we have made them sanctioned by God. When you come back and you look at the doctrine of discovery and you look at all of that has the patina, or it has the appearance of being ordained or sanctioned by the supreme being.
Or blessed.
Or blessed by the supreme being. Now, interestingly, and I'll share this with you, interestingly, there are a number of religious denominations that have repudiated in the 21st century, and interesting, the Episcopal Church is one of those, and I want to share with you, in 2009, the Episcopal Church at, and this is certainly at the headquarters levels of all these organizations, and they wrote, resolve that the 76th General Convention repudiates and renounces the doctrine of discovery as fundamentally opposed to the gospel of Jesus Christ and our understanding of the inherent rights that individuals and peoples have received from God, and that this declaration be proclaimed among our churches and shared with the United Nations and all nations and peoples located within the Episcopal Church's boundaries. This doctrine, which originated with Henry VII in 1496, held that Christian sovereigns and their representative explorers could assert dominion and title over non-Christian lands with the full blessings and sanction of the church. And I think it is, our challenge is that this is embedded our religion is wrapped so tightly around this thing. Now, while I think certainly all of these faith denominations at the 40,000 foot level, at the headquarter level, have repudiated this, I do not know that that has gotten down to the pulpits of everyday ordinary people. I'm not hearing that. I did a presentation not too long ago to another group, and in the audience were several people that I knew, but there were also in the audience people who held extraordinarily high positions in theological departments at major universities who said to me after the presentation, said, you know what? I've never heard of that.
My goodness.
And so I think what we have to do in this country, and you and I have talked about this, is that we have to begin to find a way to have honest conversation. And we really need the equivalent, I don't know if you want to call it a truth and reconciliation, you want to call it a lamentation, whatever you want to call it, but we've got to find a way to have honest dialogue about our past. Someone has said that the history that we teach is a mythological history. It's not really history itself. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, and I realize I'm rambling on here, but I think a lot of that we're wrestling with is we've got to come back and make the connection. We've got to get back before 1619. We got to get back before 1776. We've got to talk about what is really underneath this. And not a lot of people are going to like that. Churches, as I said, you know, when you asked me about Christianity and the church today, is there enough evidence to convict you of being true to your faith?
Well, John, I just want to say that for me, your ramblings are always instructive. You teach me what I need to know, at least part of what I need to know, not everything. And as a white man, one of the things I say about myself a lot these days, even though I am now in my 70s, is I don't even know what I don't know.
Okay.
And listening to you reinforces the reality that we all have things that we don't know, and we all have things that we don't even know we don't know, until someone else takes the time to open some additional historical truth and information for us. So this leads me to, I guess, really what are the last questions for us, because our time is running out.
Sure.
So as you well know, I came onto the board of the Lynching Sites Project, and at my first meeting, I was elected president.
Right.
Which I would never recommend to any human being on the face of the planet. Your first meeting, you're on the board and you're president. And I served in that capacity for almost, well, about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And you were the executive director. And now roles have changed. I'm still on the board. I don't have a title other than being a member of the board. But you have resigned as executive director. And Dr. Kevin Brooks, who has been interviewed on this show by Bishop Phoebe Rowe, he's the new executive director. And John, you're now the president of the board.
Yes.
And so this mantle has fallen on you in a different kind of way, a mantle of leadership and responsibility. It's the mantle of the legacy of Ida B. Wells and others. I also know that you have, in my experience, always been a strong voice of reason and truth. And I'm just wondering, these days, how strong do you really feel, knowing what's going on in the latest news? And I just want to share one other piece about Minnesota, which some people might assume, you know, why is all this going on in Minnesota? Why is it not happening in the South?
It is happening in the South.
It is, of course, happening. It always has been.
No, even in Minnesota, it's still in the South.
Yes.
If you're south of the Canadian-U.S. border, you're in the South.
Ooh, now, see, this is what I didn't know either.
Okay.
I needed to learn that the South is south of the northern border, not the
Mason-Dixon
line. Why, right. But here's what I wanted to say about Minnesota. First of all, my brother lives about an hour and a half from Minneapolis. And I need to check in with him to see how he's doing with all of this that's been going on. But in the book that I mentioned a while ago, White Christian American book that Robert P. Jones wrote,
right,
He quotes an 18th century philosopher, Edmund Burke. And actually, this quote is on a memorial that is now in Duluth, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. The quote is, "An event has happened upon which it is difficult to speak and impossible to remain silent."
Mm-hmm.
Both are true. And this is a memorial to three men who were lynched in 1920 in Duluth, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
10,000 people came to what we now call a spectacle lynching.
A form of entertainment.
A form of entertainment. And finally, in 2003, a white woman in Duluth shepherded this memorial and these statues to be dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
And then there, of course, are the what we might call the 21st century lynchings of George Floyd and Dante Wright.
Right.
So how, my friend,
mm-hmm.
how is it that you feel today? How do you keeping on? What gives you hope?
Well, it's two things. Let me tell you what keeping me on, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the hope side of that. What keeps me going is, and I think some of them may be listening now, I wake up every day, every single day of my life. I wake up, and all day long throughout the day, I think about my sons, and I think about my grandsons, and I think about my great-grandson.
Yes.
I go to bed at night with them on my mind. And when I look at Philando Castile, I look at George Floyd, any of those people, I look at Sandra Bland, I can lay the pictures of my personal relatives, my children, my grandchildren, I can lay them right beside them and say, either one of these is them. And so you asked me what gives me hope, and I'm going to cut to the quick here. There is a young man that has recently taken over as the president of the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. And if you know the history of that, then you know that that's a big Confederate area in there. But, and he's had a very, he's black. He's the first black president they've had. And he's had a pretty tough experience. But he made a statement, and I want to read that statement and say, this is exactly where I think I am. He says, and I'm going to quote him, he says, "I remain steadfast in the belief that there is no problem that we cannot solve together through rational debate and compassionate discussion in the full light of day." And his name is Reuben Brigitte, the second president of the University of the South. And I remain that same way. And to go back, when we did the L Persons, I mentioned that people fled in all directions when lynchings occurred. L Persons' family fled. A month before we did his 100th anniversary, we found his great-grandniece in Chicago, and we brought her down here, and she made a very short speech. And one of the things that she said to all of us, the only way out is through. And that holds true for us today, even as I look at the George Floyd, the Derek Chauvin case, the Dwayne Wright, as I look at all that, the only way out is through.
John, we're out of time, but thank you for reminding me of that wisdom. The only way out is through. And it's my job, I guess, as the host today to remind you to, you can find the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee on Facebook, Instagram, and episwtn.org. Past episodes of Faithfully Memphis are on Spotify. And this is Tom Momberg for Faithfully Memphis. I want to say the final words that I'm going to say, but I want to also say we're going to go out to a little bit of Marvin Gaye, "What's Going On?" Because that's the question we all need to be asking.
What is
going on? And so,
and thanks for having me.
You're welcome, John. Thanks for being here. And everybody, stay safe, stay well, stay positive. Don't need to escalate.
You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me.